Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week is a big one. We're chatting with lead character designer for Blue Eye Samurai, Brian Kessinger. I want to give a special shout out to all the patrons that help support this podcast. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Eight-Legged Bird, and Jacob. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a member of our Patreon channel to help support this podcast and get all of these episodes early and ad-free, follow the link below and sign up today. Last little bit of housekeeping before we roll into this episode. Brian is currently working on a new project and he's popping it over on Kickstarter. Follow the link below, check it out, and if you're digging what he's putting up, make sure you throw some money his way to help crowdsource his next project. Now, let's get on to my chat with Brian. So let's take a step back and start at the humble beginnings. So how do you get on Blue Eye Samurai?
So it's so funny how it all kind of lined up, because I was actually slated to start a show at Marvel. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to direct a new animated show over there. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to start on there, the show got canceled. And I was like, oh, great. I have no job now, right? Like, I got to find a job. And so I put it out there on my Facebook page, you know, just because I got a bunch of friends in the industry and that sort of thing. I'm like, hey, I need a job. Does anyone know of anything? And at the time, Jason Shire, who was working on the show really early on, he called me in. He said, dude, I got this show. Would you be interested in doing character design? Because up until this point, I've mostly done storyboarding and story art. And I go, yeah, I love character work and that sort of thing. So I met with him and he showed me the kind of concept art that had been done so far. And oh my gosh, it was amazing. It was so good. And then I got to meet with our supervising director, Jane Wu. Mm-hmm. And she's incredible. We could do a whole episode on her. But basically her passion for the show and her talking about doing exactly what you were describing, you know, about how to visualize it, how to make it look different, all of this stuff, that was all in her head. And she had a vision and she's like, you know, I haven't seen this done before. I think we can do it. And so she was really inspiring, right? I was like, oh, I want to work with this person. And then the third component was when she shared the scripts with me and I got to read at the time, the first five scripts were written and they were incredible. Like the show that you saw hardly deviates from what the scripts were. So like reading the scripts felt like I was watching the show and I could see it in my head. And it was something I'd never worked on before, you know, coming from Disney Animation. Yeah. It was very different, right? And I know you've met with Emil, and he and I worked at Disney for a while together, but nothing like this, right? And after I was done reading the scripts, I'm like, oh, I think I need to work on this, because I knew if I didn't, I'd be so jealous of whoever did work on it. Right. Like I could kind of see in the future a little bit, like between Jane, the showrunners and kind of what they were going for. There was going to be some potential there.
Oh, there's a massive potential. Like I said, this is my favorite thing Netflix did last year. I mean, you guys absolutely crushed it. Now, what I find so fascinating, you said you came from boards. Now, I don't think I've ever asked this question. I've had so many character designers, board artists, and writers on from all facets of animation. Do they have something like a board test for a character designer? Did you have to do any kind of test for it?
No, it's funny. They didn't. I think the show was moving at such a pace, like it had to get going, right? Mm-hmm. And they needed someone quick. And I believe they were able to look at like my website, right, and see my previous work. Yeah. And because I had done a lot of personal illustration outside of my story work, they were able to extrapolate, okay, I think he can do it, but I've grown really close with Jane over this production, and she jokes a lot that she's like, how's this white boy gonna be drawing all these, authentic Japanese characters when all he does is like Olaf and, Moana, like all this like really broad family animation stuff. So I think she was more nervous than she professionally let on. But luckily I was able to prove myself pretty quick.
With that being said, this is a super stylized show. So when you're stepping into this, I love the illustrations you do, by the way. So some of your personal work, your non-Disney work, the steampunk stuff, it's I've like I was never a fan of steampunk, probably until Blue Eye Samurai. Like I liked it, I loved looking at it, but it just wasn't for me, right? I was like, I'm perfectly comfortable. If something's not for me, it's not for me. There's other things that are, right? But watching Blue Eye Samurai, I'm like, oh my God, I love whatever this is. I love this. And I'm talking to my friend about it. He's like, well, it's steampunk. And I'm like, really? This is steampunk? And he was like, yeah. I mean, I don't see how you don't get that. I was like, this is beautiful. This is stuff. So I started going a deep dive down, like watching your work, your comics and your illustration. I was like, wow, this is just so really cool. So with that being said, man, you're like a chameleon. You do Disney, you do your personal stuff, and now you're doing this. How hard is it for you, and you particularly, to like switch styles like this?
Yeah, thanks. It's a skill you have to practice, and I think it speaks to the longevity I've been able to have in animation, knock on wood, is the whole thing with animation is it needs to feel like it was all drawn by one the same person, right? And so part of your training early on, especially in the hand-drawn days, right? Because I started more in the hand-drawn era, or towards the end of it rather. And so it was very important that you be able to identify a style and work with a style guide and have your drawings match. So kind of it was trial by fire, by being at Disney kind of in my younger days, of just having the style, having to learn the style of Tarzan versus the style of Treasure Planet versus the style of Atlantis, right? Like you start to identify what makes what, and you build up that visual catalog in your mind, and it becomes kind of like how those people that can do impressions really well, right? Like, so I kind of consider myself kind of like a visual impressionist, right? Like I can see something and break it down to what makes it have the style that it does, and then kind of emulate that.
Now, with that being said, what are some of the things that like you're absorbing or starting to go down a rabbit hole and watch and read and look at to inspire to create these characters within this world?
For Blue Eye Samurai, it was all about research and authenticity, because this was going to be a chance to visually tell a story about a group of people that, as a culture, has a specificity from other Asian cultures, right? And a lot of times, Asian iconography kind of gets blended together, right? And those differences aren't usually accounted for. And it was very important to Jane that she now has a chance to tell a story where those details matter, right? Where the collar of a kimono for our Japanese characters was going to look different than the collar that for a Chinese person or a Korean person, right? And so early on, it was just about absorbing the research of the culture and then looking at the art styles of the time, specifically the woodblock prints, right? And how the Japanese people of that time rendered themselves, right? How they looked at themselves, how they observed the world around them and interpreted that. We also looked at porcelain dolls that were made at that time, as well as the big breakthrough for us was looking at the Bunraku puppets, which we can get into, because my favorite episode is 105, which is Tale of the Ronin and the Bride.
Oh,
And
yeah.
That actually has the puppets in the show. So that got kind of meta because those puppets are really what influenced how elongated our characters were. It was also inspired by fashion illustration. If you look at the efficiency of line and the kind of caricature that you would see in fashion illustration, it's very elongated and reduced to the bare minimum of line work. We didn't want to over-render these characters, especially because the woodblock prints weren't rendered that way, right? It was a lot of line work and then color blocking. We were going to let the backgrounds carry our high frequency details and textures and let our characters almost flatten out graphically on top of that so that they were separated and your eye always knew where to look in the composition to find our character's eyes.
So with the characters, and thank you for breaking that down. I've been writing stuff down while you were talking. It's one of my favorite things about doing this podcast because I get to learn so much. I get to learn a
Cool,
little bit
cool.
more and go a little bit more in depth about what you guys do. And
Yeah.
one thing I want to circle back to was you breaking down, just the things that you guys were having to consume in order to get in that mindset to make sure you guys were real deal on the era and the circuit you guys were on for that specific time period of Japan, feudal Japan. And with that being said, Emil had hit that like really on the head. He was like, we had to make sure all of our I's were dotted, all of our T's were or checked or whatever that phrase was. But he's like, we had to make sure that like to the smallest of details that it was there, it was true, and it was authentic. Because he said the same thing. He's like, a lot of those times you see, you see it in Spanish cultures too. Like people assume,
Yes.
oh, that's Spanish. Well, no, that Spanish is Spain. It's not Mexican. It's not Puerto Rican. It's this
Correct.
influence. So it's that same con. It's that same the same con. Not complex, but it's the same thing with that with the Asian culture as well. So I'm
Yeah.
glad you guys did that because I think that's what set this so far apart. And now you're starting to see things like Shogun came. I don't know if you've watched that one, but that one came like
Yeah.
right out. And
Yes.
watching some of the behind the scenes things on that, they're hitting and echoing the same sentiments you guys are talking about, making sure it is 100% pure and authentic to the best of your abilities. That's a long-winded way of getting to this question I wanted to ask. But when you're doing this and you get those five scripts that you said you didn't really deviate from because it was just all there. How easy was it? Was it easier to create these characters to flush out their emotions, their motives, and everything like that, having so much and just being able to deep dive into that culture?
The challenge came from our showrunners coming from live action and not having animation experience, right? So they were used to, writing scripts. They worked on Logan, they worked on Blade Runner 2049, worked on a lot of like really cool stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
But they were used to casting, right? Like looking at headshots and dealing with a certain amount of realism that typical family animation or even adult animation doesn't really afford you, right? So I bring that up to say we couldn't use our standard bag of character design tricks. Like, oh, okay, this script says it's a bad guy, so I'm gonna give him a scar on his face, right? To show, like, oh, this is a bad dude, right? Like, none of that flew. The kind of guiding words for our character design principle was realism and restraint, and kind of taking away details so that they presented a little bit more realistic, right? And a little more grounded, I think is a better word, than the stuff we normally work on in our team. Even all of us Blue Eye Samurai artists, we were all coming from a different style of animation. So the challenge came in just finding designs that worked for their comfort level or their taste level. And it's cool because I think I know for myself personally, they made me a better artist because they gave me a very specific sandbox or Zen garden, if you will, to work within. And so it was very challenging because I had to, okay, tighten up, edit, find these things. So Mizu as a character was really challenging. And in fact, I'll share a YouTube link. I put together a little visual progression of all of our work from like the first sketch Jane did of Mizu to all the way to the finished frame. And it's very interesting to see how the character evolved from looking like a more standard animated character to the sort of watercolor Bunraku version that she ended up being.
When you were explaining that, the visualization I got in my head was, I'm pretty sure you've seen the t-shirt because it's one of those things that's always been done, but like the evolution of man. So like the thing walking out of the water, you know, goes to the monkey and eventually he's in a business suit. So that'd be pretty cool to see. So as soon as we're done with this, I'm going to go check that out. Now with sticking with those characters, not so much, you know, who was the hardest to draw, who was the easiest to draw, that type of thing. Which one do you think you had more of an emotional attachment to when you were coming up with the creation and trying to flush these characters out?
Oh, that's a good question. I really like Swordfather.
Oh man, me too. I'm so glad you brought him up.
Yeah, I really dug him. Like he was so inspiring, and like he was so like open-hearted, you know, and such a mentor to Mizu, and I kind of felt that way with like my team of artists. Like I had such a great team of character artists working under me for the show. And I felt like I kind of got to be the Swordfather for them.
Yeah.
So he was really great. And he was a really fun kind of pushed design. We really got to kind of exaggerate his face and play around with his arms, and he's got all that kind of battle damage on his arm from the burns and whatnot working in the forge. So he's pretty great. I dug Swordfather.
Dude, I loved the dichotomy is not the right word. I can't think of the word I'm trying to use, you know, for him, but I loved how he would give her the advice that a father would, but he would be grounded and realistic and oh man, I really wish I could find the word I'm looking for. You know, the perfect example is when, you know, she's back on there. She had just gotten the shit kicked out of her, you know, and she's starting to make this blade, right? That's going to kill Fowler. And then he alludes to it, and then he brings it up. You know, the reason that blade broke is because there was so the what I love about Japanese culture, and particularly like the samurai, the ronin, the swords, is it's you know, even my kitchen knives, because I have quite a few Japanese style kitchen knives that were handmade. Yes. You know what I mean? So somebody putting their essence essentially into that, making that blade, hammering out all of those imperfections. And that's what he was trying to do through repetition. You're beating out these things that is an ego, right? So it's an ego death essentially. Right. And I loved the metaphor. I think that's what I was looking for. I loved the metaphor that was Swordfather. Everything she was doing, it was like Mr. Miyagi. There is a reason you did wax on, wax off, paint the fence up, down. You know what I mean? It was just such a cool way, and to know that he was blind. Right. You know what I mean? It was just like, it was all by feel, you know, and it was just, he was such a complex but simple character. I mean, it was just, I don't know how many times I got to tell you that you guys fucking crushed it on the show, but in that character in particular, he, like I said, he was just such a cool character. I can't really think of like anything I've ever seen with a character kind of like that. You know, he reminded me at first of Shang Tsung from Mortal Kombat. You know, he had that vibe to him, just not evil and trying to steal your soul. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Trying to give you soul. Right.
Right.
But yeah, I'm so glad you brought that character because he was such a cool character. You know, and another character that I loved was, and I'm pretty sure everybody does, was Ringo, right? I loved the
Yes.
opening, how you get introduced to him. You know, he has no hands and he wants to be the guy that is known for noodles, right? He wants to
Yes.
be that guy. And
Yes.
then through all of this adversity, he finds ways to make his environment work for him, which I thought was just so fascinating. How does this come up? The guy that wants to make noodles, but he has no hands, right? You know, how
Right,
does this guy come
right.
up?
Well, he was actually inspired, if I remember the story correctly, by Michael Green, who was one of our showrunners and writers. He had a friend in college who was born with the same limb difference, right? So it wasn't like an accident that took his hands. He was just born without hands. And Michael's friend wore like a really like cheap kind of gold watch, and with that watch he could put any implements in and just
Make
function,
it work.
make it work. And so that really stuck with Michael, and he really wanted to honor that, you know, to have, you know, a disabled character who isn't defined by their disability, right? And it's kind of cool to watch the show, and you forget that he doesn't have those hands, right? Like, because it's just not something we shine a light on. And it's funny to, because there's been a handful of Ringo cosplayers that I've seen at like conventions and stuff, and they look fantastic. And but it does take you back when you see hands. You're like, oh, that's right. He does look a little different. But yeah, so it was very important to kind of A, show that kind of level of representation, but then also be a counterpoint to Mizu, because Mizu's got so many issues, right? She's so messed up. And she, because of the world she was born into, you know, she sees herself as a monster just because of her eye color, right? And so we wanted to put her against a character who had a much more visible difference, right? And show how capable and how open he was, right? Like that it didn't let him slow him down. So there was a cool balance between the two of them, right? That I think was a good visual story.
It was just really cool seeing the hero not really played or built like a hero. It was an anti-hero, but not really an anti-hero.
And we rarely get to do that in animation. Like the number one rule of animation is like, oh, your main character has to be likable, right? And we went through so many screenings of movies at Disney where it's like the big note was like, well, I don't like the main character, and you could like hardly ever find flaw in your main characters. So it was really refreshing on this show to just embrace this broken character who has lots of things that need fixing, right? And we see her stumbling through that journey and making the bad choices, but it just makes you kind of lean in and almost fight for her more,
Makes her
because you,
human.
yes, exactly.
Now, with a character like that, hypothetically, you know, this is just your personal opinion. If you were to take this character, this show, and you do it like 20 years ago, right? With that character flaw, that character trait, you know, if you will, for Mizu, does a character still get the same amount of set? Because I just feel like with the last 20 years of cinema and animation, we're made to not so much. It's always got to be a good guy. It doesn't always have to be black or white. A lot of characters are gray now. You know what I mean?
Yes,
So, do you think something like that could have worked 20 years ago with a character like Mizu that wasn't black, wasn't white, that kind of rode that line?
I think so, but it would have had to have come out of Japan. Like, I think it would have only been like a true anime storyline, because they were doing stuff like that back then, right? Like, they were doing mature animated storytelling, but I don't think, you know, in a landscape of Osmosis Jones, Tarzan, and what was the other one coming out about that time? Like Anastasia, I think, or even Iron Giant, which I love Iron Giant.
Favorite movie of all time. Favorite animated movie of all time. Whatever.
Yeah, it's incredible, right? But yeah, I don't think it could have been made back then, just because I think too back then, animation was a lot more insulated. So mm-hmm. you had people that were like really into Disney animation who had never seen anime, right? Yeah. Or vice versa. There's been so much more sharing and building between the two now that it'd be interesting. I'd love to see a 90s anime of Blue Eye Samurai, though. That sounds kind of cool.
Dude, if there's one show that I'm so glad Miyazaki is still doing traditional animation, because yes. it gives me hope that somebody will go, fuck, this is still possible. People still want this. Because what I thought was so fun about Blue Eye Samurai was the style. Like the first couple minutes of watching the first episode, I was like, man, I don't know. You know, it was interesting. It had my attention, but I was like, it was so different. And I don't know I still have a very hard time with like some of the words that can be used to describe it. You know, I put this in the same vein of like Amazing, or not Amazing Spider-Man, excuse me, a Spider-Verse, Across the Spider-Verse and oh, wow. the Spider-Verse movies, right? So it was this mixed, I'm pretty sure it's the wrong word, but it was like this mixed media, right? It was uh-huh. this stop animation. It seemed like claymation. It was this, it was that. The frame yeah. rate was a little bit slower. Then it was a little bit more sped up. It was a little bit more CGI. So you have 360 turns. It like Blue Eye Samurai had that vibe to it where it was like this whole different category. Like you can't really explain this or compare it to anything else, because until Blue Eye Samurai, I've never really seen something that was so stylized like this in particular. You had series mm-hmm. and stuff, but this one just set it so far apart, you know, from any kind of competition. I mean, when you guys are in the animator's room and you guys are sitting there talking and conversing about how to flesh out these characters, mm-hmm. what was it like trying to take on the style that they were pushing with the old 1500s, I think is what that era was from, right? 1500s?
Yeah, 1600s.
1600s, yeah. Right. What are some of those talks that you guys might have? Like, are you guys like trying to fight for like specific clothing or, you know, specific style of these characters? How does something like that flesh out?
Thank you for asking that and yeah. for the kind words. But yes, it was a big discussion. And in fact, you know, I had started, a bunch of us on the crew had started in 2D animation mm-hmm. and Jane herself started in 2D animation. And this originally, I don't know if this has gone out there, but this originally started potentially as a 2D animated show.
Really?
That we were, you do a thing that they call vendor tests, mm-hmm. right? You take a sequence from your show and you board it out and you send it to different studios around the world, different vendor studios around the world. And they produce that sequence in their style, right? In what their studio can do. So it probably can't be released for contract reasons, but there are sequences of our show that were done as tests that are in full hand-drawn animation.
Really?
And yeah, it's kind of cool looking, right? But where we found that the 2D was breaking down was that it wasn't able to handle the richness of the textures of the kimonos, gotcha. Right? Like all of that stuff has to be rendered frame by frame, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're doing it by hand, then the complex floral pattern on a Kemi's kimono would have to be a lot simpler.
Gotcha.
And so that was something Jane wanted. She wanted a certain level of opulence to the show mm-hmm. that CG would afford us. So we're like, okay, and we're going to go CG, but then let's really work on our line quality, because I think that's something when you're mentioning, you're trying to find the words to describe, because in addition to the frame rate, in addition to the posing, line quality does so much for you. And if you look at a lot of other shows that do this sort of CG character but rendered 2D line, the lines are a lot thicker and they're heavier. And they're impactful. They look cool, right? Like mm-hmm. it's a neat look. But we wanted to pull away from that and say, how can we do this just with a level of elegance, right?
Yeah.
And again, looking back at the line work of the woodblock prints, how can we copy that? So I would do drawings with my really thin rapetograph pen that doesn't have thick and thin to it. It's just like a single thickness. And we worked with our vendor, Blue Spirit, who was in France, and they developed a special line just for this show. And the one thing we added to it as well was that if you watch the show again and watch it on a bigger screen, you'll notice that that line actually moves and jitters a little bit. So it really has the feel of the that it's being drawn every frame.
Oh, wow.
It's like a subtle thing. Like just give it a little. Yeah, check it out next time. Check it out on like the biggest screen you have. And especially in the close-ups, you'll see that the line has a life to it. And that's something that I think added to that feeling you're talking about.
You know, with something you had mentioned, you said it was your favorite episode, The Tale of the Ronin and the Bride. I loved this episode. I loved how I wish I could have gotten another episode just like this one just as long, because that was the only critique I could have, is like when it ended, I'm like, please, no, please give me more of this one, of this period, because it was just such a cool way to tell why she is the way she is, like how she became this person. And I think it was such a huge, you know, usually you'll hear such a huge disservice, but it was such a huge to service to do this at the midway point, or, you know, it was a little bit more than halfway through this, because I think you've got such a buildup of this character, right? You've got this Superman-esque character. Nothing can stop this cyborg, essentially, or this alien. And then you see that, oh shit, she had this fall from grace. It wasn't just her being born to a white man and in a non-white culture. It was her falling in love. Then you don't know if it was her mother. Spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen, you don't know if it was her mother or if it was her lover that turned it in. And the fact that you guys didn't give any kind of definitive answer made it that much more impactful, and that much, it was such another, here it goes. I'm such a cool fucking, I feel like you ever watch SNL with Chris Farley, and he's like, he's got, he's like, hey, Paul, remember
that part? Yeah, no, totally. That's
that was
great.
So cool.
I love it. I love it.
But that's just what this podcast always feels like. It's like, remember when you guys did that really, really cool drawing? Yeah, that was pretty cool. But I loved this episode. Why was this episode? Because you'd said it was your favorite episode. Why was this episode your favorite?
Because of the storytelling. Because of how it...
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
How it enriched a character, right? Because there's a saying in storytelling that you want simple stories and complex characters, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this show is that to a T, right? That the characters are so complex and so deep that the fact that we got to tell this story, we got to go in and we got to explain why. We kind of, you know, you take almost what you think is a bottle episode, but it actually tells her story, and the cross-cutting with the Bunraku storytelling also made me just like love that we were telling this in three different layers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me was like really exciting and really engaging. And you mentioned you don't know if it's, you know, Mikio or Mama that betrays her. And Jane's got the perfect answer, because they use that question comes up, right, a lot in the panels and stuff. And Jane has the best answer. And the answer is it's the world that betrayed her. Right.
Oh, that's so perfect. Yeah.
Right. Like, it doesn't matter if it was him or her. It was going to be someone one day. Right. And so the fact that it's all tied up in that episode. And then I think what's so smart about that is the showrunners explain who she is, why she is, gets you that much more attached to her. So that when we go into the next episode and it's just like a video game, like hack and slash, you're that much more alongside her, right? Because we've gone there. Like, if those episodes were reversed, I don't know that, you know, the sixth episode would have played as well as it does.
Dude, it's that age old question. Is it nature or is it nurture? And then she found a beautiful way to, man, that lady is so fucking smart. I mean, she, like, Emil had nothing but just these great things to say about Jane. And because so I'm going to ask you the same question I asked him, because I just thought it was a fun question. So when I'm a huge Samurai Jack is my favorite cartoon from the Cartoon Network series of all time. It's perfect. Right. And what I loved about it is a lot of the guys, for the life of me, I can't remember the, I think it was Brian Andrews. I believe it was Brian Andrews, the storyboard artist. He's at Marvel too.
Yes.
And he, I believe it was him, knows so much about martial arts. So whenever they were doing a technique or a pose, or Jack would throw some kind of move, he was the guy who's like, no, he wouldn't do it with this style. If he was doing like Taekwondo, it would be more like this, right? So he was that guy. And Emil said it was the same thing with Jane. Like, she knew everything about the martial arts. So I asked him, I'm like, did she ever show you any kind of martial art moves on you? Did she practice on you at all? And he said, no, she never did that. So did Jane throw any kicks or punches your way, Brian? Did she get to show you any cool martial art moves?
Unfortunately, no, just because we were all on Zoom. So, you know, but next time I see her, I'll try to come at her.
Yeah. And see what she does.
like does. I think that'll be the only way, because she certainly showed us on screen, and we would actually do like life drawing sessions with her as the model, so that we could get the drapery of the clothes right and that sort of thing, and the different moves. No moves on me, unfortunately.
So two things I want to hit on. Please do it at the Emmys so we can get it on video, just in case she hits you.
Perfect.
She hits you with the perfect judo throw. The second thing is something I've been fascinated with. It's there's this book. It's back here. It's the Disney Revolt book that Jake S. Friedman wrote about the strike back in the 40s with Walt Disney. And one thing he was talking, Art Babbitt, he would say, like, art would, like, they invested in teaching the younger generation of animators that were coming in. Like, they would have classes, how kind of how Cal Arts got started. He was like, all these they started teaching and everything. And life drawings was a thing. How difficult is it to do life drawings over Zoom? I have to imagine it's like, you can, in a classroom setting, you can get like right up to the subject and you'd be like, okay, her elbow is like this, or her leg was like this for this kick. How difficult or how much harder is that through Zoom? Because you can't get as close as you can as you would in person.
Yeah, it's not ideal. It's still better than nothing. But the problem with doing it online is your camera lens is always fixed.
Yes.
So you're always kind of looking. I'm not sure what millimeter lens a typical laptop camera is, but you know, when you're there in person, you can really, like you say, get close. And if you want to work on foreshortening, you could really, you know, get your foreshortening in there. It is difficult. It's better than though doing from still pictures. You know, I think a lot of times students think, I'll just draw a pose I see in a photograph. And I say, well, that's still good. You're still learning. But in person would be the best. Live model on Zoom would probably be second best. And then going from photos is probably the third.
Gotcha. Yeah. I've never thought to ask something like that. Yeah. I don't think life drawing is actually probably the first episode and almost 200 episodes that we've talked of life drawing. So
it's very important, you know, not just for character design, but for story and for the story artists out there, you know, go to the drawing classes where they have, you know, 30-second poses, that sort of thing. Cause you want to hone that quick sketch.
Oh, absolutely. I can imagine. That's a great tip, ladies and gentlemen. So make sure you implement that into your everyday drawing. You know, so as we start to wind down here, man, we've talked some characters, we've talked stylization, we've talked, sorry, my dog's trying to sneeze. talked a whole bunch of other things with the show. You know, when you sit back and you think about the show, obviously, you know, was this your first Emmy
First Emmy, yep.
We're always going to remember that first, man, right?
That's
So
right. That's right.
that's a really cool moment to get it on something as special and everlasting, and that it's just so different, like Blue Eye Samurai is. So, when you sit back and think about your time on Blue Eye Samurai, is there one thought or one memory that comes up? You know, what's the first thing you think about when you hear that term, Blue Eye Samurai?
Without sounding cheesy, it's definitely the team I worked with.
Yeah.
Like, think about it, because it's a very hard show. It's the hardest show I've ever worked on.
Yeah.
Just from the scope of it, the sophistication, the, you know, the violence, the sex scenes, like all this stuff was like new ground and had to be kind of developed from scratch. But our team was just so great, and we got together, so we got along so well. And I'm speaking of the team in general, but then if I even just drill down to my little character team, my four fangs, as I would call them, like, they were awesome and so collaborative and looked out for each other. And so, because that's the thing with animation, is these projects take time and they're stressful. So, you really want to make sure you're at least having a good time and working with people you like to work with. And the fact that then after that, the show has been recognized, you know, the tremendous fan art we're seeing, the tremendous cosplay. It is up for best animated series. So that's, if you're an Academy, Television Academy member now, you can vote for that. The voting's open. And so hopefully we can snag that best animated, but the fact that it's gotten the accolades it's gotten, is icing on the cake.
Oh, I can imagine. And with this show in particular, obviously you said it was the most difficult thing you've had to do thus far. What are, if you could isolate three, one, two, three things, if you could isolate that you took from this show that you're going to keep in your bag of tricks when you go to your next series, is there anything that you can point to that really stick out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me think. Because there's a lot. Being thorough, like really considering the work that my colleagues have to do after my work is done.
Yeah.
Like being in a smaller crew and a smaller, you know, even with our great teammates in France at Blue Spirit, you know, realizing if I take the extra time now just to make sure everything's buttoned up and explained, it will help them that much more to do their work and to make it better, right?
Yeah.
So being thorough, being like kind of like even keel and calm about things, right? Like not letting, because it was daunting at times, and you know, whenever things got a little too overwhelming, I would think back to the phrase Jane would say all the time, which always made me laugh, is like, how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time. Yeah. Right. So it's like, okay, one bite at a time. But we only have one hand we can draw with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just make sure we're doing that. So that helped. And then the third thing would probably be open to new experiences like this show.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if 10 years ago I would have had the courage to say yes to something like this.
How come?
I think I was more concerned with being comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and kind of staying in my lane and not challenge. Like I had gotten to a certain point in my career where I was like, okay, maybe I can just coast for a little bit and
yeah.
enjoy this, you know, which I did. But then now, especially as we look at how rocky the animation industry is right now, and there's a lot of There's a lot of challenges. We there were several times where we thought this show was going to get cut.
Really?
Right. And just, you know, as the industry started to shrink, we thought for sure we were on the chopping block. So I'm glad I took this risk, because it also gave me the tools to be more flexible should rocky times like this appear, you know.
You know, if you could go back in time and tell yourself at the beginning of Blue Eye Samurai, when you first get onto the job, day one of Blue Eye Samurai, if you could tell yourself anything from what you know now, is there any one thing that you would tell yourself?
Stick with it. It's going to be worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we were basically a startup. It's funny. Even though we were at Netflix, the way, you know, Netflix kind of operates is each production, especially during quarantine, each production was kind of its own silo and was kind of responsible for getting your own stuff done, you know. And I was coming from Disney Animation Studios, right, which was this big, you know, kind of ship that had all sorts of safety nets and mm-hmm. and big budgets and all that sort of thing. So the early days of Blue Eye Samurai were a lot of like, how are we even going to do this? This, you know, script one has 150 background characters alone, right? And we have no crowd budget. So how are we going to develop a system so that we can have background characters and all that sort of thing? So it was a little frantic, but if the ghost of Christmas future came and said, hang in there, because, you know, you're going to make great friends. You're going to be a better artist coming out of it, and you'll get a cool trophy. It's all kind of worth it.
I have to imagine. And we'll end it with this one, man. If you can summarize your experience in one word, one sentence, one phrase, hell, even one paragraph for Blue Eye Samurai, what would that one thing you would say be?
It's funny. It makes me emotional thinking of it, but I would say gratitude.
Gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grateful for the skills that I've learned, grateful for the people I've met, grateful for the story I got to tell, and that, you know, that Mizu as a character has been able to speak to, you know, certain, you know, people like non-binary people and people who identify as other genders, like that they have found a voice and a character through something we got to help create. Those are the very nice messages and DMs that we get behind the scenes that are very special.
Oh, I have to imagine, man. It's gotta make you guys feel good knowing that you guys did something so special for so many people out there. Now, I know before we let you go, man, if the fans want to come find you, so obviously we're going to put your social links in the bottom below. So, ladies and gentlemen, you'll be able to point, click, and go tell Brian how great him and his crew, just absolutely how cool. We're going to go back to that word, ladies and gentlemen, how cool Blue Eye Samurai really is, man. But I know you've got a website out there, and I know you're getting ready to launch a Kickstarter for your next project, man. So can you give us some information on the Kickstarter and your website?
Yeah, thank you so much. So
absolutely.
My website's easy. It's briankessinger.com. The hardest thing to remember is Kessinger is only one S, not two S's. So you go there, you can see everything. I've got, you know, past projects I've worked on, and we got a little store there, because my side hobby is writing and illustrating my own books. Some of the stuff you mentioned, the steampunk mm-hmm. stuff. So, in September 14th, around that time, we're going to be launching a new Kickstarter for my fourth book in the series of Otto and Victoria, which is a, steampunk girl and her pet octopus, and they have kind of adventures and that sort of thing. And so that's coming up soon. But if you head to either briankessinger.com or Brian Kessinger on Instagram, you'll be able to catch up and follow along.
Well, cool, man. If I can circle back to one thing you said, I've got a lot of gratitude for you, man. You guys created something that was so special, so beautiful, so pure. And I cannot wait till we get to see the continuation of this story because, like I said, if I can boil anything down, man, Blue Eye Samurai. Ladies and gentlemen, you got it. It's fucking cool, man. He's been Brian. I've been Julian. It's been the What's My Head podcast. And this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of. And just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.